From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, for the first time in this country, an entire execution was broadcast. It was part of a program called The Execution Tapes, a public radio special report, a joint production of WNYC, which produces this program, and the independent radio production company Sound Portraits. The program included reports, panel discussions, and a national call-in, but the centerpiece was the broadcast of the execution of Ivan Ray Stanley, recorded in 1984 by the Georgia Department of Corrections. The broadcast was, needless to say, controversial.
Given WNYC's role and my own involvement, I produced two reports for the special, there is no end to the conflicts of interest inherent in our attempt to grapple with the controversy. Nevertheless, we are devoting the first part of this hour to doing just that.
We begin with an excerpt of one of Brooke's reports with some history of the debate and how public radio came to acquire and broadcast the execution tapes.
There was a time in America when attending a public execution was both possible and popular. The last time was in Kentucky in the summer of 1936, when thousands of spectators gathered for the hanging of young Rainey Bethea, convicted of rape. Newspapers said it was a boisterous affair. History tells us that's often so. The unseemly celebrations may have been part of the reason executions were taken behind closed doors. The states do allow for witnesses, including reporters, but no cameras, no tape recorders. The rules are challenged from time to time, most recently in California. But most judges accept the argument that cameras and broadcasts would expose the prison staff to the risk of retaliation and increase the likelihood of riots. And so until this week, there had been no broadcasts of executions, live or on tape.
The presence of a camera would be a severe disruptive impact on the prison population, and that is definitely a safety and security issue.
Terry Thornton represents the California Department of Corrections.
The courts have traditionally, when they rule in this sort of thing, they realize that prison officials know more about how to manage and operate prisons than the courts do.
Outside the court, the public is similarly disinclined toward cameras.
My perception, based on people I've talked to and radio shows I've done, is that people who are against the death penalty tend to also be against broadcasting it. People who are for the death penalty also tend to be against broadcasting it.
Jane Kirtley is a specialist in First Amendment law and journalism professor at the University of Minnesota. She holds the minority view that freedom of information should prevail, especially with respect to the death penalty.
People have asked me, what do you think would be the consequence if we broadcast this? And my answer is that I have no idea. I don't know which way the pendulum would swing. All I know is that if we were able to broadcast executions, people in making those judgments would be much more informed in doing so. And I can't see how that's a bad thing.
Michael Mears is an Atlanta lawyer. In 1998, he was in the middle of a long campaign to challenge the constitutionality of the electric chair when he learned through some case files that the state of Georgia had been taping its executions for 15 years. He got the tapes and used them as evidence in his suit.
We found that it's a very bureaucratic process. They wanted documentation that they had crossed all of their T's and dotted all their I's. And so the audio tapes were used for that purpose.
A small story that mentioned Mears and the tapes was noticed by a radio producer in New York.
I couldn't believe it. It seemed like it would have been a mistake. But we made a phone call down to Georgia to this attorney, and indeed he had tapes of every execution in Georgia. I was blown away. I couldn't believe that these things existed.
That's David Isay, who's responsible for the broadcast of the execution tapes. 6 months ago, he produced a documentary called Witness to an Execution, conversations with people who had participated in or been present at dozens of executions in Texas. He got the tapes from Michael Mears and listened to them. Isay decided that in any program about the tapes, one full execution must be broadcast. He selected the execution of Ivan Ray Stanley on July 12, 1984. Isay chose that tape because it was one of the earliest recorded and so was more descriptive. Also, Stanley's execution was not unusual. There were no mistakes or malfunctions. Stanley's was a typical execution, as executions go.
That's one of the extraordinary parts of this story, because when we dug into this completely random case, we found out that there were a number of interesting facts about the case. One was that Stanley was retarded. He had an IQ of 62. The other was that the murder that Stanley was involved in, which was a horrendous murder of an insurance agent in a small town in Georgia, was actually carried out by two men, Stanley and his partner, a guy named Joseph Thomas. And Stanley claimed he was a bystander. He was involved in the robbery, but he didn't commit the murder.
The entire execution of Ivan Ray Stanley is documented on this tape, including the parts most witnesses never get to see. The moments, for example, when the prisoner is led into the chamber and strapped into the chair. Usually, witnesses file into the observation room after the prisoner is confined to the chair or to the gurney. A curtain opens, and they see only the moment of death, and then the curtain closes. David Isay.
This is the only opportunity the American public will ever have to see everything that happens from start to finish in an execution. It's never going to happen again. This is a curtainless document, and that's part of what makes it so extraordinary.
Isay maintains that he hasn't put this tape before the public to provoke a particular response about capital punishment, and it's possible that it'll change no one's mind one way or the other. Certainly many people, even those who hold the same views on the death penalty, will hear the tape very differently. Wendy Lesser is the author of Pictures at an Execution. She doesn't want to hear the tapes, and she doesn't think anybody should. In fact, she believes they only obscure the human drama that actually took place. Much better, she says, to let a reporter tell the story than to hear it described moment by moment, as on the Georgia tapes.
If you go through a reporter, you always get the human element. Even reporters that are in favor of the death penalty, when they witness somebody being executed, they include some sense of shame and pain and difficulty at being present at this event.
Producer David Isay.
There's something about the soul of a person is in their voice. And there are certain stories that are very well told on the page, but you're one degree distant. And with these tapes, you're one degree closer. So I think it's much more immediate and much more powerful to actually hear the voices and to hear them distilled through a reporter's pen.
The tape is a neutral document. Individual listeners will have to determine for themselves if they are hearing a soul or soullessness, closure or just another crime, justice or revenge or all these things at once. All that is known for certain is that this is how it happened.
This week, the Gallup organization released a new poll. Gallup asked just over 1,000 adults if they would watch the upcoming execution of Timothy McVeigh if it were broadcast on television. Of course, the federal government has decided to air the execution only on closed-circuit TV for the families of McVeigh's 168 victims. Though 81% of those polled agreed McVeigh should be executed, less than a quarter said they would choose to watch if it were on national TV. Later in this hour, we'll present a range of opinions concerning the potential impact of televised executions. But first, we will air a brief excerpt of the execution of Ivan Ray Stanley. By doing so, we take the position that hearing the tape will inform the argument for or against playing it. It's a paradoxical position, but there it is.
What you are about to hear is a moment-by-moment narration by a prison official who's watching the procedure through a one-way mirror. The booming sounds are doors slamming elsewhere in the institution. There's no sound from the execution chamber, no sound of electricity, only the voices of the participants. The portion we will play begins after Ivan Ray Stanley has been strapped into the electric chair. If you choose not to listen, you can rejoin us after 1 minute and 45 seconds.
The wires have been attached and secured to the headset and to the leg band. The perspiration has been wiped again from the condemned's forehead, and the hood is being placed on at this time.
say 12:15.
The phase hood has been secured. All of the warden and all execution team members have departed the execution chamber. Stand by for the warden's last telephone check.
Ralph, this is Commissioner.
Yes, sir.
There are no stays. You can proceed to carry out the official order of the court.
Very well. On my count of three, press your buttons. One, three. Colonel Lowe?
Yes.
Mickey, the execution is now in progress. When it first surge entered his body, he stiffened, and I heard a pop as if one of the straps broke, but I can't tell from this vantage point. He is still at this time sitting there with clenched fists with no other movement. He's slowly relaxing at this time. The first phase of the execution is completed. We are now into the second phase. Second phase is completed at this time. We are now into the third and final stage. From my vantage point, it seems that the inmate has relaxed somewhat. His fists are still clenched, but there's no movement from the condemned.
We want to know your reaction to our program this week. Do you believe executions should be broadcast? And what do you see as the missing pieces of this story? Write us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. We also invite you to our website at onthemedia.org. There you'll find more information, including the link to all of the Georgia Department of Corrections tapes obtained by Sound Portraits Productions. You can also hear the entire program of The Execution Tapes, a public radio special, at wnyc.org.
In the next part of the program, listeners respond to the broadcast of the execution tapes.
Over the past few years, I feel like I've gotten less and less strongly against capital punishment, and hearing these tapes today convinced me that I'm not anti-capital punishment.
Also, the arguments for and against televised executions and how the victims' rights movement has affected the coverage of crime and punishment in America.
You're listening to NPR's On the Media.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. After the execution tapes aired, several public radio stations opened up the phone lines so listeners could discuss what they'd just heard. Stations in Dallas, Seattle, and San Francisco aired local programs, while former On the Media host Brian Lehr moderated a national discussion carried on about 20 stations.
Radio call-in shows aren't statistically significant research samples, but connecting to the public is one of the things radio does best. Brian Lehrer compiled some of the listener comments and came to these conclusions.
One of the ironies of hosting a radio call-in program is that the most rote discussions often spring from the most complex issues. Abortion, handguns, and yes, the death penalty. Life and death become tired talking points. It's understandable, I guess, the sides are so clear politically, the arguments have become etched in stone. So when the execution tapes aired, it was a chance for people to react to something they'd never heard before.
I think it's too late to think that broadcasting an execution is going to somehow touch us emotionally, because I mean, we're already way beyond that. We've seen everything happen on TV. And eventually, you know, we're going to have to start having a little bit more gruesome executions. And then we're going to have to start having some little unusual executions. And then we'll start having the outtakes from the executions.
That from Phyllis, a listener to Dallas station KERA, which aired a call-in show immediately after the special. On Seattle's KUOW, Aziz held a minority opinion.
Definitely I would watch it, and definitely I would encourage my family to watch it. Kids, I think maybe even our relatives, we would all get together on a first-time basis if this was done, and all of us get together and have a discussion about it.
Obviously, a call-in radio show is far from a scientific gauge of public reaction. Might even be worse than an internet survey. But the results of a poll conducted by CNN were interesting nonetheless. The CNN program Talk Back Live asked the question, should the execution tapes be aired? And it featured viewer reaction.
Bill, in the audience, you have a problem with these tapes being aired.
I think it becomes a form of public entertainment, and I think this is one type of entertainment that we just don't need.
That man's sentiment was the majority opinion at the time. Sentiment started out 2-1 against airing the tapes. But as the program went on and they played the actual tapes, voting wound up exactly 50-50. A couple of callers to the program I hosted reported that their opinions were affected by the broadcast.
But I'm just now becoming not a fan of capital punishment, and mostly just because of listening to the tapes.
Jennifer from Dayton was the second-to-last caller on Wednesday night. She was the first who said the tapes had actually changed her mind in any way. The last caller on that program, Judy from Brooklyn, also changed her mind.
Over the past few years, I feel like I've gotten less and less strongly against capital punishment, and hearing these tapes today convinced me that I'm not anti-capital punishment.
Those in favor of capital punishment sometimes want executions broadcast because they think the spectacle will deter potential murderers. But other supporters of the death penalty do not want executions broadcast. They fear the ugliness of the moment will heighten public sympathy for the killers. Opponents of capital punishment are also divided on the broadcast issue. Some think televising executions would show them to be inherently cruel and barbaric, and that such acts by the state should be open to public scrutiny. But others fear bloodlust, that executions would become entertainment. What's clear is that tapes like the one public radio aired and any future broadcasts will cause at least some of us to reconsider one of the most serious acts our government carries out. For On the Media, I'm Brian Lehrer.
The listeners' varied reactions to the execution tapes often echoed the convictions of academics and critics on the issue of televising executions. This week, after the broadcast of the tapes, CBS newsman Mike Wallace stated the major case in favor.
It is public policy in America to put people to death in many states. Let the American people who vote for the politicians who favor the death penalty, let them see it.
First Amendment lawyer Martin Garbus added another widely held position, that if the public saw what went on in the death chamber, opinion would swing against the death penalty.
You will find some racial patterns, the enormous proportion of people executed being black. You'll also find that many of the people have IQs of 55 and 60.
Former Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall believed that most Americans supported the death penalty precisely because they knew so little about it. The testimonials of the listeners we just heard suggest it can go either way. Paul Layton is a professor of criminology at Eastern Michigan University. He says information is frequently irrelevant.
By and large, researchers have found that people don't know a lot about the death penalty, but they also don't really care. They have strong opinions that just don't really change because of exposure to information. And a lot of it seems to be kind of almost an ideological predisposition.
Studies conducted in the 90s do suggest that support for the death penalty drops if people are required to be active participants, such as jurors or executioners.
So there is some way in that making the death penalty more real seems to have the effect of decreasing support, but we don't know quite how this would play out in terms of a televised execution. Would people really see it as real? Or is this kind of reality TV, or is this just another program?
Just another program, answers Wendy Lesser, author of Pictures at an Execution.
The way people watch the news and not get disgusted or outraged by it,
I have no doubt that people could begin to watch executions and view it as another form of reality TV.
Or you'd have something worse.
Robert J. Lifton is the author of Who Owns Death?
You'd have an outpouring of vengeful, sadistic feelings on the part of the public, and we all have some of those feelings.
Paul Layton says that there is some evidence to suggest broadcasting executions might actually increase violence rather than deter it.
Following a well-publicized execution in particular, homicides actually increase rather than decrease. And the basic reasoning seems to be that people get the message that violence seems like an acceptable way to resolve a problem. And that's the message that gets out much more so than crime doesn't pay, because people identify with the state and they don't identify with the criminal.
The only media outlet that requested permission to record the execution of Timothy McVeigh was a small internet site. The request was denied, but attorney Martin Garbus still sees the recording and dissemination of executions as inevitable.
Nobody wants it to happen, but you will be watching it on your computers at the same time that the state is denying you. You're going to have people walking into these executions with little cameras that are then going to be shown all over the internet.
So far, we have no hard evidence to guide us in predicting what the impact might be. The only American experience to date occurred this week with the radio broadcast of the execution tapes. The reaction has been passionate on both sides. One critic who strongly opposed the broadcast is Matthew Felling of the Center for Media and Public Affairs. Mr. Felling, what is your general objection to the broadcast of executions, either on television or radio?
My first problem was one of an agenda. As much as the producer may have been quoted in the New York Times as saying that this was not a program designed for or against capital punishment, the only reason that these tapes are available is because of an enormous opponent of the death penalty in Georgia fought to have them released.
But how relevant is the source? Isn't it really the impact that we should be assessing here?
Well, the impact is, quote, bringing about a dialogue. Bringing about a dialogue only occurs when someone is unhappy with the current status of things.
Leaving motives aside for a moment, what are your objections to the broadcast of executions, either on television or radio?
Well, I believe that the first thing that someone convicted of a capital offense should forsake is to become a political icon or a martyr. Broadcasting these tapes, whether it's audio or television, contributes to this as you focus solely upon the death of the criminal and all the detail given to the death walk and the strapping and the mask over his head. You almost completely ignore the crime committed by this person.
Would you have been more satisfied with our broadcast if it had included a story about the victims?
I think that WNYC broadcast this topic as responsibly as possible. But the problem we see occurred within the same evening. You did depict the victims' fates. And then later on that night on television, these same tapes were simulcast. And the victims' fates were, by and large, omitted. The only brief mention of them was what the condemned was sentenced for. And those details, in terms of telling the story of crime and punishment, it's the entire first half.
So is your principal argument then that in the hands of less responsible media, these tapes would be ill-used?
Yes. It's where this could lead. What's to stop broadcast television, commercial television, from using this as a precedent?
Should responsible news organizations be held hostage to the actions, the potential actions of irresponsible news organizations?
I believe that journalism should not be dictated by the habits of the lowest common denominator. But I don't think we need to go so far as to show the graphic nature. Even if it's radio broadcast, it's still quite graphic. We don't need to go that far. Press is always represented. And if you want to know the last words of the condemned, you can always read up on that. And that's the main purpose of the media, to serve as a conduit, not to eliminate itself and allow people to see what they are supposed to be covering.
Matthew Felling, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Matthew Felling is the media director for the Center for Media and Public Affairs.
When the press covers an event as delicate and polarizing as an execution, its every move is scrutinized. When ABC's Good Morning America announced that Charlie Gibson would anchor McVeigh's execution coverage from Oklahoma City, not Terre Haute, in consideration of the crime itself and of its victims, suspicion quickly bubbled to the surface. Was this grandstanding, or was it genuine sensitivity? And if it was sensitivity, did it portend a new relationship between journalists and the victims of the crimes they cover? David Weston is the president of ABC News. He joins me now.
Thank you for having me.
In the New York Times a couple of days ago, columnist Frank Rich took a nasty shot at Charlie Gibson's stated desire not to send the wrong message in execution coverage. He wrote, "Since when is a network news anchor's job to send a message, let alone by his choice of urban backdrop?" What's the answer to that question?
I read that and was frankly surprised at Frank's comment, given his background and his experience. Every time we decide who the anchor will be and where the anchor will be and how they'll be situated, we're communicating something with the audience, whether we intend to or not. So it shouldn't be surprising to anyone that in deciding that it's going to be Charlie Gibson and that we're going to put him in Oklahoma City, that was a substantive editorial decision and we're trying to convey meaning through it.
And why Oklahoma City, and what meaning are you trying to convey?
Well, the execution of Timothy McVeigh is a big issue, and it's an important story for us to cover. It's an important story because a citizen is being executed, but in all honesty, there are a number of those that happen around the country each year. This is particularly important because of what happened in Oklahoma City. We had not only 168 people killed, which in itself is a significant story, but killed in a domestic terrorism act, which historically in this country we've avoided for the most part, unlike some other countries. So Oklahoma City really is the focal point for that.
There's this stereotype of the TV reporter thrusting his microphone in the victim's face and asking, "How do you feel? How do you feel?" Do you train your reporters at ABC News, you know, not to be bulls in a china shop in the gathering of information, particularly a sensitive story like the Oklahoma City bombing?
Well, we certainly talk about that, and we warn one another and caution one another about it. In all honesty, I also talked to some of the people down in Oklahoma City in advance about how we would handle it, with specifically the concern in mind that you identified. At what point are we intruding on personal grief?
What happens when treading lightly around victims, for example, affects news coverage or even compromises news coverage? Have you seen that happen in any of your reporting to date at ABC News?
There are times when, unfortunately, the need to report the story to the American people has to take precedence over individual sensitivities. We try to do that only when it's appropriate and only when it's necessary, but we will not compromise our coverage in the name of sparing feelings.
Beating the Today Show, for example, I suspect, is a very important part of the lives of everyone at Good Morning America. To what degree does the decision of where to put Charlie Gibson play into your competitiveness with the Today Show, and how do you think it's going to turn out?
We are very competitive. You're quite right. The specific decision with respect to Charlie was made, as I said, because I think it's the right editorial decision to make. I am hopeful that we can beat the competition, but that's a matter of what the right decision is rather than do we think it's going to get us more ratings or less ratings. That never entered into discussion, and it certainly never entered into my thinking on the subject.
So if this should turn out to appeal to viewers on sensitivity grounds, that's just gravy for you.
Well, listen, we always want to reach as many people as possible, but that was not the motivating force behind that. We're doing this because it's what we feel is most comfortable for us and also is most consistent with what we believe ABC News should stand for.
David Weston, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
David Weston is the president of ABC News, one of my three media employers, in addition to Advertising Age and, of course, On the Media. Joining me now is Bill Cote, professor of journalism at Michigan State University. He is the co-author of Covering Violence, A Guide to Ethical Reporting About Victims and Trauma. Professor Cote, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Has the coverage of crime, especially the handling of victims, changed over the years?
Well, it has. For the most part, it's shamefully deteriorated. I think competitive pressures have gotten worse, that we're seeing more and more graphic and violent films being shown. We're seeing more graphic descriptions in newspapers, in magazines. But we've been seeing some hopeful signs that within the past few years, at least, that there is some sincere effort to actually improve it.
Now, you've co-authored a handbook on sensitivity. Can you give us the principles?
A key principle is that when you go in to cover a story, approach it as if you were in the same shoes as the person you're interviewing. How would you like to be interviewed? How would you like to be approached? And after the story is gathered, either for print or broadcast, are there ways that you can present it that, so that you celebrate not only a person's death, but also celebrate that person's life?
You say you've detected a shift, a pendulum shift back towards sensitivity. Can you pinpoint when that began?
If I had to pick on just one, I'd say that maybe Oklahoma City really, I think, brought home to people throughout the nation and maybe the world that there are ways of covering terrorism without terrifying even more people.
When does sensitivity and deference to victims and to next of kin actually get in the way of good journalism?
There are some times, if you're trying to be deferential, that if you see somebody crying or you see them upset or if they yell at you, that you may not go ahead and get the story. And sometimes that does not work in behalf of the victims, and it certainly does not work in behalf of the community.
In the Oklahoma City case, it seems that local and national media have bent over backwards trying not at least to inflame the families of the victims. Now ABC, in covering the execution in Terre Haute, will actually be anchoring its broadcast, at least of Good Morning America, from Oklahoma City. What do you make of that decision?
Well, I know there's considerable controversy about that, which surprised me a little bit. I understand that that could be considered grandstanding on the part of ABC, but I think from a victim reporting advocate's viewpoint that it probably is a good thing that we've got at least one important network who is going back to where this all happened in the first place and is trying to remind us of the setting and to remind us of what happened and to remind us of what is going on in the lives of the survivors and the families.
Bill Cote, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
William Cote is co-author of Covering Violence, A Guide to Ethical Reporting of Victims and Trauma.
Coming up, preparing for the media circus in Terre Haute and a look at the impact of televised executions abroad. This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 2 years ago, the Indiana city of Terre Haute learned its federal prison would hold the system's only death chamber. Back then, residents couldn't envision what is happening now. The world's media is heading to town to cover the first federal execution in almost four decades, the death by lethal injection of Timothy McVeigh, mastermind of the Oklahoma bombing. Some of the media have already arrived in advance of the May 16th execution. Reporter Tom Rogers was among them to see how the city is taking it.
As the editor of the Terre Haute Tribune Star, Max Jones has met many of the first wave of reporters to come to town to write profiles of the city in advance of the McVeigh execution. And he's heard his neighbors critique them.
They just expect that somehow we're going to be made out to be a sleepy, one-horse, backwater, cornfield of a town. And you know, that some people find a lot of charm in that. But some people don't like to see the community, they like to see the community portrayed as a progressive, bustling, which that wouldn't be a fair interpretation either. So, you know, we are what we are.
What Terre Haute is an unwitting backdrop to the end of one of American history's most painful and high-profile crime stories. It will test people's patience. School is canceled May 16th. Virtually every police officer in Vigo County will be on duty. And protesters will be huddled into two city parks and then bused to the prison in the wee hours of the morning. The media will have shuttle buses, too. As many as 1,500 reporters and crew may show up. The good news is they'll also bring expense accounts. That means business for Terre Haute.
Can you take it home with me?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Raul David tends the meat counter of his small market on the outskirts of town. You can see the sprawling federal penitentiary out the front window in the distance. David plans to be open all night before May 16th, selling ice, sandwiches, and soda as protesters and reporters mingle just inside the prison grounds.
I'm just a businessman. I take care of my business. I'm interested in my business. I'm not interested in the others.
And you just happen to be across the street.
Accidentally, I happened to be across the street from him.
While it may help the store, the attention to the execution has at least one of David's customers wanting to tune out.
It's starting. Man, I didn't even ask off of work that day. My kid's out of school. I would have to go 23 miles out of my way to get to daycare. That day on the 16th.
Business owners admit they'd rather make money on something less distressing than the McVeigh execution. And the president of the Terre Haute Chamber of Commerce, Rod Henry, says those owners should not be apologetic about it. They're simply serving the media the same way they serve their customers every other day of the year. What angers Henry are the execution T-shirts in the window of a downtown tattoo parlor. One includes a mock-up of a newspaper called the Hanging Times, and a picture of McVeigh with the headline, Die, Die, Die.
You know, we actually think probably we'll have more problems with the image from the T-shirt than we will from the actual event. But it's sad to think that people are trying to exploit, you know, opportunistic, you know, trying to make a buck. And they cite the example of, well, if the inns are going to make a buck, if the restaurants are going to make a buck, the gasoline stations, then we should be given the chance too. That's developing a carnival atmosphere.
It's hard to say if any stigma against Terre Haute will linger after the reporters leave. Rod Henry of the Chamber of Commerce is confident it won't.
How many people today remember where the trial was held? But, you know, you're always going to remember where the bombing took place. But are people going to really remember that Denver, Colorado is where the trial took place? And are they going to remember that Terre Haute, Indiana is where closure was brought, at least on this part.
In the meantime, though, the hotels are booked, the parking spaces are arranged, and the temporary satellite dishes and cell phone towers are going up in Terre Haute. And residents like Max Jones of the Tribune Star are bracing themselves.
It will be somewhat of a spectacular sight, I think, when you start moving almost every major news organization in this country and perhaps in the world, suddenly setting up a central headquarters on this site. It will be something that will capture attention. And at that point, I guess there's a potential for some sort of community backlash against the media attention.
The crowds haven't arrived yet, and the city is taking it in stride for the moment. The last time Terre Haute had a brush with widespread media attention, it was far different. It was 1979, when an Indiana State basketball star named Larry Bird finished his college career. For On the Media, I'm Tom Rogers in Terre Haute, Indiana.
In Terre Haute, journalists are converging to document the backdrop. Elsewhere in the world, the media play a more direct role in bringing the graphic reality of capital punishment to the public.
The year was 1996, and Guatemala was crippled by criminal violence. The government of Alfonso Portillo Cabrera came to power on a promise to take action, Against the tide of recent history in the Western Hemisphere, Guatemala restored the death penalty. The first execution by firing squad was seen nationwide on Channel 7. Martin Rodriguez of Prensa Libre newspaper was one of millions of Guatemalans who watched as the executioners botched the job. When the prisoner failed to die in the rifle volley, an officer used a pistol shot to the temple to put the condemned out of his misery.
Given a shot of grace, tiro de gracias, it's in Spanish. It had a high impact.
Guatemala is not unique. In the past few years, executions have been televised in Afghanistan, Thailand, Russia, China, Nigeria, Iraq, Vietnam, Saudi Arabia, Kazakhstan, and famously, in the case of the Ceausescus, Romania. The reasons, according to law professor and capital punishment historian John Bessler, are obvious.
In some countries, it's often used as a mode of social control or repression to essentially scare the population. A place like Iraq or a place like Libya, where they've shown hangings after they've taken place on television.
In the United States and Western Europe, the opposite has happened. While clinging to the punishment that most of the industrialized world has abolished, the U.S. began in the middle of the 19th century to take executions far from the public view. The carnival atmosphere and civil disorder surrounding executions had alarmed the states and opponents of capital punishment alike.
The abolitionists felt that once public executions were abolished, that it would only be a matter of time before capital punishment altogether was abolished.
They believed that the cloak of secrecy would nullify the state's deterrence rationale, and that public bloodlust, in the absence of actual blood, would diminish. As it turned out, brute violence has continued to stain American society, and public support of capital punishment, while fluctuating over the decades, has remained high. 81% of Americans, according to a new Gallup poll, support the execution of Timothy McVeigh. So it stands to reason that a newly uncloaked process, as in Guatemala, would find a ready audience. Although 76% of the U.S. public, according to the same Gallup poll, claim they wouldn't watch McVeigh's lethal injection even if they could.
That's a lie. I think most people are going to at least watch it once, and they will watch.
J.D. Healy is owner and curator of the Museum of Death in Los Angeles.
One, because they've never seen one before. Two, there's always that chance that something might go wrong. And three, it's history.
And four, because of the simultaneous titillation and revulsion that draws us to the macabre. Martin Rodriguez of Guatemala's Prensa Libre notes that while Channel 7 sued the government to televise executions, citing the public's right to know, the network confidently marketed the execution as a TV event.
You know, when you saw the publicity, it was like, oh yes, someone is going to be killed, and you can watch the execution on Channel 7. But a lot of people did watch it.
To historian John Bessler, a foe of capital punishment, that clamor to witness the ultimate justice is a perversity easy to understand. What he doesn't understand, if state killing is supposed to be a deterrent, is the combination in many democracies of ultimate justice and secrecy.
Japan has the most restrictive laws. They don't even notify the public that an execution has taken place. The only way you can really find out is to check the family registry. And if the name is crossed off, then you know that the execution has taken place.
Even Amnesty International, the human rights organization, finds such opaqueness bizarre. Thus, Amnesty finds itself in the unlikely position of championing execution broadcasts to show the public the gruesome reality behind the sanitized debate. Senior Department Executive Director Kurt Gehring.
To the extent that footage or pictures help the public to realize what's actually going on, it does serve the larger purpose.
It's a paradox, but as we've observed, the question of capital punishment is riddled with them. So maybe it's easy to shrug and accept the counterintuitive Amnesty International position at face value. Societies need to witness capital punishment in all its horror in order to rid themselves of it. But is it really true? Zafar Yab Ahmed is a Pakistani journalist in exile from political persecution in his own country. He has witnessed and documented repression, corruption, and violence in a country where newspapers are filled with images of murder and mayhem, bleeding and leading. But what haunts him most are the front pages from the Zia regime of the 1980s of prisoners dangling from the hangman's noose.
People do not understand the role that images play, and how do they go down into their psyche, and how do they rupture what is peaceful.
The terror, he says, is consuming.
It brutalizes society at a level that you can't estimate. It cannot be quantified. And it does change values. It does change, affects human relationships. And it does kill something in the society, which is very human.
Surely, when public policy intrudes on the human spirit, much of the debate, much of the passion, much of the principle simply evaporates. What lingers, indelibly, in Lahore or Guatemala or Georgia, is the picture.
One recurring concern expressed about the broadcast of executions is the brutalizing effect it may have on a culture already awash in media violence. We wondered how we got where we are and where the broadcast of executions might lead. Joining us now is Thomas Daugherty. He's the head of the Film Studies program at Brandeis University. Welcome to On the Media.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Today, death plays a major role in a lot of feature films, but death didn't play so big a role in early Hollywood, did it?
Well, although death has always been the lifeblood of drama, under classical Hollywood cinema, the Production Code, which was the Hollywood censorship agency, really regulated exactly what you could show if a person expired on screen. In fact, usually, unless it was the most sort of melodramatic, quiet death, death wouldn't be shown on screen at all. The classic example of this would be when, like, James Cagney is dragged off to the electric chair. You see the lights dim, and you see maybe the shadow of the guard throwing the switch, but you certainly never see Cagney in the chair sizzling.
That's in the movie Angels with Dirty Faces. Did the viewing public agree generally with the code?
Generally, they seem to, because after the code is enforced in 1934, box office attendance after going down in the early 1930s goes up. Now, there might be other reasons for this, but by and large, I think it's probably fair to say that the production code from about, the mid-1930s to the mid-1950s, when it starts waning, was a pretty good reflection of popular attitudes.
But it's fair to say that the public in general does not feel the same way today as it did back in the 40s.
It certainly does not. And one of the reasons, I think, for this comes about with the Second World War, which is the time that you really first start seeing explicit, grim, grotesque imagery of death and violence on the American screen in a documentary context with combat newsreels and combat reports, which bring some of the horror of the battlefield to the home front. Now, of course, to our eyes, these things were censored quite rigorously. But in the context of the time, during the Second World War, audiences really were seeing images they had never seen before on screen.
What about television in the post-war era? Were images of death, real or fictional, as common on the small screen as they were on the big screen?
Oh, not at all. When television becomes the consensus medium in the 1950s, it really adopts a very Victorian attitude to any depictions of violence or death, and doesn't really start changing, of course, until the Vietnam War, in which you have combat footage of death on the battlefield. The other key moment, of course, with death in television is the live killing of Lee Harvey Oswald on November 24, 1963, at the hands of Jack Ruby, which most Americans remember seeing live, although it was only broadcast by NBC live.
Many of us think we saw the Zapruder film back then, too.
That's correct. The Zapruder film was not shown publicly until the mid-1970s through the offices of Geraldo Rivera. And when he showed it on his late-night show, you can actually hear the audience gasping in horror because they had never seen images like that before. And I think the response of that audience is early as the mid-1970s to a scene that, although I don't think any of us take any pleasure in, certainly, but certainly I don't think we gasp the way we used to in the 1970s when we see an image of horrific violence.
You're still talking about reality-based programming, though, for the most part. When did death become popular entertainment?
Well, death has always been popular entertainment, but if you're talking about something like our contemplating showing a live execution on screen, that's a very recent phenomenon. And when television now is basically broken down any barrier between public and private, and the kind of events that used to be private now are deemed fit for public broadcast everywhere. And so it seems almost a natural extension of this tendency to have executions be broadcast on television.
What, in your opinion, is the impact of this endless parade of grisly images?
Well, what it does is it normalizes grisly images and it normalizes executions, and that, of course, is what television does to most anything.
Could you talk about the fascination, what I call, what a lot of people call the train wreck syndrome? You just can't drive by?
In Plato's Republic, there's this wonderful moment, as it were, in which some guy's walking by a battlefield, and next to him are all the carnage of battle, the dead bodies, and he knows he shouldn't look, that he'll be repulsed by it, but he can't not look. And finally, he gives up, and he gazes over the battlefield, and he says to his eyes, "Oh, look, eyes, get your fill of this scene." I think that we've had that tendency for 2,000 years. Think of yourself in a horror movie. The typical horror movie spectator gesture is to put your hands over your face, but to have the fingers spread apart far enough that you'll be able to look when you want to. And I think we always have that sort of repulsion, attraction to scenes of death and violence.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thomas Daugherty is the head of the Film Studies Program at Brandeis University.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from David Sirchuk and Kathleen Horan. We would also like to thank Sound Portraits Productions.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.